Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you. You may be seated. Thank you very much. All right. Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you all. This is cause number 03232947, ACS State Healthcare LLC and Conduit State Healthcare LLC versus M&M Orthodontics, Dr. Scott Malone and Dr. Diana Malone. If I could have counsels introduce yourself and announce ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Jason LaFon on behalf of Conduit and its predecessor, ACS.
Yes, sir.
And I'm ready.
Thank you.
Good morning. Jason Ray for M&M.
All right. Thank you very much. Councils, as you may be aware, today we are live broadcasting this on YouTube, so your friends and family can be watching today, as well as it will be preserved for later today, and also the audio will be on the court's website. As you know, we have the appellant will open with 15 minutes, and then the appellee will have 20 minutes for their case. And then I understand the appellants are choosing to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We've got our timing system that is incredibly high tech, with the green meaning you've got a green light to talk, yellow meaning you have 2 minutes left to start wrapping up your thoughts, and of course red at the conclusion. Certainly if the my colleagues and I have questions of you, we may exceed that time, certainly. And we've got Justice Smith and Justice Theofanis here looking forward to this presentation. But more importantly, you have a live audience here with a group of scouts that we are hosting here in our presence, getting their merit badge. And I thought Justice Smith kind of identified it well. I'm not sure that they are concerned about Medicaid and whether there's agency or contractor status, but they are concerned about a badge. And it may just simply be learning how to be patient and be quiet badge. That may be what their badge really is today, but we are honored to have them with us and seeing the system of justice live and in action. So it's our pleasure to host them today. So make it good, no pressure at all, but this had better be more entertaining than usual, okay? And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. LaFond. Yes, sir, you may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Ms. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, and I will do my best for the scouts. presuming the court's general familiarity with the facts as laid out in the briefs, I'll proceed directly to the substance of our appeal, which is that the Malone's claims are barred by both statutory and common law immunity. For statutory immunity, we ask this court to reach one narrow conclusion, that when the state contracted with Conduit to administer Texas Medicaid on the state's behalf, the state retained the legal right to control Conduit's prior authorization activities. Accepting that conclusion ends this case because, one, the Supreme Court has held that employee status under the Tort Claims Act turns on the legal right, the government's legal right to control the alleged tortfeasor. And two, it is undisputed here that if Conduit was the state's employee under the act, then the act's election of remedies provision bars the Malone's claims. And those points are summarized in our Bench Exhibit 1. But before getting into the details of the evidence that conclusively established the state's legal right to control, I'd like to make two higher level points, one about related case law and one about practical consequences, which I hope will establish for the court that we're not asking the court to go out on a limb here. As to case law, every other court to consider the question has held that prior authorization decisions by a Medicaid contractor are the actions of the state itself. And we've cited a number of those cases in our briefing, and there are many more cases out there. And every court to consider whether Medicare fiscal intermediaries for the federal government performing the same functions a conduit did for the state qualify as federal employees under various federal statutes. And finally, the handful of state decisions evaluating whether Medicaid fiscal agents are state employees or officers under various state statutes all say yes. And we've cited those cases in our briefing as well.
With regard to the case law, can you point us to a case where the election of remedy section has been applied to a business entity as opposed to an individual person?
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe there is a 14th Court case involving a law firm in which the agent, that it was held to be an agent under the Tort Claims Act. That is, it's Ross v. Leinberger, Goggin, Blair, and Sampson. It's the first court, 333 SW 3rd, 736. And there's certainly nothing in the statute that precludes a private business from being the state's agent and from the state exercising the legal right to control a private agency. About practical consequences, if this court were to hold that the state did not control its Medicaid fiscal agent, it would be saying that the state has violated and continues to violate federal law, which allows only HHSC to exercise discretion in the administration of Medicaid. And that would potentially call into question billions of dollars in federal funding. And so I think from these points, what it shows is that one would expect the state to have the legal right to control conduit in its administration of Texas Medicaid, and especially its prior authorizations. Medicaid is a government benefits program, and it accounts for one-third of the state's budget every year. The idea that conduit was on its own and allowed to operate on its own simply doesn't make sense here.
Counsel, outside the agreement, where in the record does it demonstrate that the state actually, in fact, treated conduit as an employee rather than a contractor? Not that the contract says the word contractor in some places and agent in another, but that they actually treated conduit as an employee for the purposes of prior authorization.
Sure. So I think first we have to get to what employee means, and as the Supreme Court has said, employee under the Act, this is a statutorily defined term. So we have to go with the definition in the statute, and what the court said in Merck v. Scheel, and what the plain text of the statute means is that the employee status turns on the legal right to control. And so the first place, when you have a contractual relationship, and there's nothing about being a contractor that takes you out of the statute. Indeed, traditionally, employee relationships were by contract. And there's a 14th Court case, Lenoir, it is, and it's cited in our briefing, in which a statute labeled a doctor a contractor under various terms, and the plaintiff there argued, well, look, it says contractor, and the court there said, yeah, but that's not the same as an independent contractor. Like, there are lots of contractors, and the thing that independent contractor turns on, unsurprisingly, is the legal right to control. So the first place you look is the contract. And now Your Honor said, where outside the contract?
Yes.
Does it show that they treated them as an employee? And I think the other side put a lot of weight on the so first let me be clear that the actual exercise of control is not relevant to this term. That's clear in the Supreme Court's case law, including Love, including well, I'll just rely on Love as the main case. But my, the other side here cited the deposition of a mm-hmm. former employee of the health insuring agent who, so the state switched from a health insuring agent to a fiscal agent when it, at the same time that it was switching from NHIC to Conduent, and then she went on to work for HHSC. She testifies to, and there's documentary evidence in the record of multiple meetings between HHSC and Conduent, specifically about prior authorization. She also testifies that she had badge access to Conduent, and the contract provides that Conduent has to provide offices in its building for HHSC staff. And there's evidence about a 2008 meeting in which some concerns are brought up about prior authorization, and the state is saying to Conduent, let's think if we can become more strict about how we're doing this. So what does Conduent have to do? It has to fill out a form and make a proposal to HHSC to allow it to do this, because it's gonna require HHSC to grant more FTEs, to get more doctors in, and ultimately HHSC says, yeah, I think we're gonna do that, and then later on, it changes its mind. It just says, no, we're not gonna let you do that. And this is actually in their petition. They say, number one, that HHSC told Conduent to continue its prior authorization activities, and it says that the state would not let Conduent hire more licensed dentists to review prior authorizations.
An issue there that, since we're to review this as a motion, as we would a motion for summary judgment, does the record that exists in front of us, and we're only at a plea to the jurisdiction on whether the trial court has got jurisdiction or not to hear this case, has the record raised fact issues that a fact finder has to determine on the issue of contractor, agent, employee, and therefore that's the reason Judge Maya Gamble denied the plea, is because there are jurisdictional fact issues that a fact finder must decide.
Yeah, we submit that there are not. The Supreme Court precedent is clear that when there's a contract, that contract controls. And Supreme Court is also clear that, and
is
so-
that's a Love case? I apologize, counsel.
Sorry, Love yes, case? Yes, yes, yes. Okay. That's Love, and there are various cases that cite Love. It's also Volkswagen. I mean, Volkswagen is the most recent case that looks at the contract. And also in Volkswagen, there was the parties there tried to disclaim agency. And I'll just bring that point up because the sort of back and forth about, well, it says independent contractor here and agent there, the court can put that aside if it wants. Because what the cases say is you are looking at what the contract labels them as and what the contract terms provide as far as control. And what we've shown here is that the contract is replete with control. I mean, the most clear part of it is in the RFP section 8.9.1, where it's very clear where it says you will do prior authorizations case by case in a manner directed by the state. And in that same 8.9 subsection, it says that the state is going to monitor you in your compliance. And so if we go back to Merck, and then there are appeals where HHSC in a fair hearing can say, no, you got the prior authorization wrong. And then there's also the Texas Medicaid Fraud Act, Fraud Prevention Act and OIG, which can go back and say, yeah, this was prior authorized, but like they said with the Malones, it was prior authorized because they defrauded Conduent and the state by making false representations on their forms, so they have veto. And if we go back to Merck was a neurosurgeon who obviously had a lot of freedom in how he treated patients under his care. And the plaintiff there said that freedom meant that he was not an employee under the act. And Merck said, no, the most important things are you subject to regimens prescribed by the state? Are you subject to supervision and review by the state? And are you subject in some instances to veto by the state. And those three elements are covered by the contract and established by the contract in multiple ways and multiple points, as we've established in our briefing.
How do you distinguish yourself and your actions from GTEC? Because it seems like, and I know GTEC didn't raise Tort Claims Act.
Yep.
So you got that. And I'm assuming that if we go with you on the Tort Claims Act, we don't have to even deal with the second. I'd like an answer to that. But for right now, how do you distinguish your client's actions from those of GTEC, where they were writing the instructions, it was reviewed by the state, and the court still said they aren't cloaked with immunity?
Well, so first there's sovereign immunity, and then statutory immunity. And so in GTEC, the court said, even under the test that you're proposing, you don't succeed, because that test means you have no discretion. And so that sort of makes sense in a sort of manufacturing part, where it's like the state gives you the instructions of how to manufacture it, and you manufacture it. As Merck tells you, independent discretion does not get you out of employee status. Indeed, every state employee has discretion in how he or she does her job on a day-to-day basis. Again, Merck was a neurosurgeon, like lots of discretion in treating a patient. And so GTEC and Merck sort of hit heads there, and that shows you there that the test under GTEC, the proposed test, the court didn't adopt any test that said we don't have to, but the proposed test that failed in GTEC does not apply under the Texas Tort Claims Act. But also what GTEC was doing was GTEC was advising the state. Like the Texas Lottery Commission didn't really know about lottery tickets, and it has the responsibility to do this, but it needed GTEC to advise it on what the tickets would look like. Medicaid is completely the opposite. Federal law says that it's the state that does this. It's the state that decides medical necessity, what needs to be shown. It's the state's Medicaid manual that said HLD score of 26 or higher and you are prior authorized. It is the state that has to establish these utilization review things to keep people from accessing the Medicaid system and taking money away from other people, limited to certain forms of care. This is the top-down state to conduit, unlike GTEC, which was GTEC advising the state. But we do win on either point, Your Honor. And so whether or not this court wants to reach one or both is up to the court.
Can I interject?
Sure, please.
And this might be something that the chief, a question she had just a second ago, but I mean, is there a difference between having the ability to, as you've said, the state has the right to do all this stuff, having the state have that ability to do that and then failing to do that? Does that make a difference if the state says, well, we have the ability to do this, but then the record maybe shows that maybe they didn't do that, or they kind of turned a blind eye or something? Does that have any bearing on any of this?
No, Your Honor. I think the law and Supreme Court precedent is crystal clear on this, that the actual exercise of control is not relevant. And if you think about what's going on with the Tort Claims Act, it's a vicarious liability statute. And so you wouldn't expect the fact that the government unit lets the person do whatever they want get the government unit out of liability, because then the person is not an employee. So what the law has always been is that if you have a legal right to control, if you're not exercising it, like, that's a problem, and you're still going to be held liable for it. The whole point is, because you are going to face liability, you will exercise your legal right to control. And so the actual exercise does not matter under the test here. It says legal right to control, not exercise of control.
Counsel, does the contract at issue here, though, contain a provision that ACS is responsible for its own negligence and intentional misconduct?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. And I would say that if anything, like, that shows that the state recognized that there was a possibility of vicarious liability here, because there are various points in which Conduent is acting as its agent. Of course, if Conduent was totally independent, the state doesn't have to worry about liability. The other point of that is that contracts include lots of things to make very sure that things are not happening. And so, you know, I think no matter what the contract says, the state's going to say, you know, we're not taking on liability here, because that's just a smart thing to do when you're contracting. I don't think there's any independent substance to that, especially when you have the more specific and on-point terms that are talking about prior authorization and talking about the legal right to control. The other side has brought up those provisions when it comes to sovereign immunity, saying there's no threat to the public fisc here. Of course, we never argued there is. And just quickly, our argument on that has always been separation of powers, which is an independent purpose and an independent holding of Nettles, in which I see my time's up, so I won't go into that. But thank you, Your Honor. I look forward to further questions in rebuttal.
Thank you so much, Mr. LaFond. And let's hear from the appellees, Mr. Ray.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Byrne, Justice Smith, Justice Theofanis. Sovereign immunity is the only fully dispositive legal argument that ACS brings in this appeal. So I'd like to address that point first, and I can do it quickly. This is ACS's sovereign immunity argument. They say that the lawsuit requires the Malones to prove that the state's actions within its delegated powers were so fraudulent as to be the only way that the Malones could continue their claims. In other words, the ACS argues that the only way the Malones can win is if the state alone engaged in some sort of fraud or bad act such that on each of the Malones' claims, the only way they could win would be to show that the state was really the person that was in error. Therefore, ACS claims the Malones' lawsuit is barred by the Nettles case, but that argument's incorrect. The Nettles case could provide ACS derivative sovereign immunity from suit, but only on the Malone's specific claims that the state conspired to commit breach of contract, withhold the Malone's money, and to falsely accuse the Malones of fraud. That's it, CR 48. To be sure, the First Amendment petition, which is the live petition in this case, back from 2014, it hasn't been amended since then, contains the following words, which open the two-paragraph section of the claims that were only against the state. That's titled Conspiracy and Joint Enterprise at paragraph 63 and 64. It starts, in the alternative, former Deputy Inspector Jack Stick has stated publicly that acts and omissions of ACS were so egregious as to be outside the scope of ACS's agency relationship with the state. Assuming the same to be true, then the state conspired with ACS. So those claims were all made in the alternative. And in any event, they were struck. So the Malones currently have no claims against ACS that require proof of any state action or fraud or culpability in any way, and they're certainly not completely reliant on that. So going back, after the state sued ACS, the state sued ACS in March of 2014, remember. It's also important to note, we'll get to the tort claims issue, that this whole thing started when the Malones and other dentists sued ACS first. So the first shot that was fired was not against the state, it was the Malones against and other dentists against ACS. Now, after the state sued ACS, the Malones then drafted additional claims against the state that really mimicked the state's claims against ACS, and they filed them in this petition. Now, to be clear, the background facts and allegations in the Malones' original petition are effectively the same, or in many cases exactly the same, largely across the background and facts, as in the first amended. So the original and the first amended are almost exactly the same with regard to the facts and allegations that underpin the claims. The original petition lays all of the action and damages on ACS, not the state. Now, the amended petition sets out additional, and this is important, alternative offset claims against the state. They're offset claims only. That is to say, any time that the Malones sued the state, they never sued the state for money in the sense that they wanted to get something out of it. all of the claims that were filed were simply offset under RIATA, which at the time was a controlling Supreme Court precedent that said when the state sues you, it waives immunity as to offsetting counterclaims. So these were just offsetting counterclaims, which were essentially, if you think the Malones have committed $5 million worth of improper acts, we believe that you had some hand in $3 million of it, so the balance would be $2 million to the jury, perhaps, right? Once those offset claims were struck, and by the way, the appeal of that state's plea of the jurisdiction in this case was part of a Rule 11 agreement at, Record 191, where for the sake of making things simple, the Malone said, we're not going to waive anything with regard to this. We're just going to kind of push the arguments that we had through the 5380 case, which was the state's case against the dentists, a variety of dentists, which they say is a settlement. And it's not a settlement in this case, but in any event, we'll get to that in a second. So once the offset claims were struck, the Malone's petition returned to its original posture, which was that ACS on its own had committed various acts of breach of contract and negligence and warranty and fraud and that and all that. So it's against that backdrop that ACS attempts to apply the Nettles decision. And in Nettles, the Supreme Court denied derivative immunity to GTEC with only one exception. It extended derivative sovereign immunity to GTEC for claims that were, this is important, wholly derivative of an alleged underlying fraud by the commission alone. Boy, those two words, wholly derivative and alone, are important, because the Supreme Court struck one of the plaintiff's claims in Nettles, in restating it, it said, Nettles could, quote, prevail on her conspiracy and aiding and abetting theories against GTEC only by proving that the commission's actions within its delegated powers were fraudulent. Therefore, only if what the commission had done in GTEC was fraud could Nettles have won on her conspiracy claims. So that fact scenario is nothing like what the Malones have alleged against ACS in this case. The First Amendment petition alleges that ACS committed common law fraud and breach of warranty and breach of contract and negligence without any help from the state. But even if the state wasn't perfect, and this gets to an issue that was kind of raised, and did they or did they not do a good job of overseeing this? And I think should this matter continue, that there'll be plenty of evidence that part of the reason that ACS settled with the state for the largest Medicaid settlement of 230-something or 40-something million dollars was because the state was on the hook to the feds for losing control of the prior authorization process. The idea that the other side would say it's impossible to say that the state lost control of this is belied by the actual facts, by the news, that the reason that the state needed to go get money from ACS was because the state was subject to two federal audits that said they had lost control, and that they had in fact allowed something that although counsel would say, hey, the law says that the state can't delegate this stuff, so therefore they couldn't have delegated it. Right? Well, that's, the law says it, but the fact is, the feds seem to think the state lost control, and that will come out should this case be remanded for further issues related to that. Otherwise, I think that won't be an issue with regard to the Tort Claims Act. But we need to remember what Nettles really stands for, and it actually denied immunity for GTEC and allowed the claims against GTEC to go forward on all claims that were attributable to GTEC. And that's all that the Malones are asking for in this case, is that the claims attributable to ACS be allowed to proceed. So in that case, the court should affirm the trial court's judgment on ACS's second issue. So ACS's first point of error argues that the Tort Claims Act bars the Malone's lawsuit. And
before we get there,
yes, ma'am.
In Conduit's reply brief on that second issue, one of the things that they argue is that nowhere in your briefing do you distinguish your case at all from the Harris County case, the Merck case, or the Love case. and they are arguing that those are relevant to the sovereign immunity issue in that regard. Is there any response that you have to their argument that, you know, there's a hole in your briefing as it relates to those cases related to control and oversight?
Well, it's common that in looking back at my previous work, I find holes in it. And that's no same thing here as well. But the idea that Volkswagen, I believe it was my reading that Volkswagen, the Love, and the Merck case all dealt with agency issues and all dealt with master-servant relationships. So I'm not sure that they were really relevant to the sovereign immunity issue, but I think I had planned on addressing them with regard to the
Tort Claims Act.
Yes,
all right,
ma'am.
Certainly.
First, Volkswagen is in a Texas Tort Claims Act case. And while it is a newer case, its fact pattern and holding are so distinct that it can hardly be considered helpful in resolving whether ACS provided facts to support its claim that it operated as an agent of the state. Chief Justice Byrne, I think you drew an important point, and that is what the contract says and what it meant and how it played out, whether it is important. And I don't think that there's a factual basis here upon which this court could reverse the summary judgment, essentially, that the trial court entered with regard to ACS's claims. Now, whether or not, and I did some research, but I couldn't find anything that would equate the agency relationship in a Texas Tort Claims Act case and whether or not it's the same as a sovereign immunity umbrella, I couldn't find anything that actually put those two together in a way that would be helpful to the court. But I will tell you that the Love case is so old that I think it even predates the Texas Tort Claims Act, 64.
Is that the 64 case? Yeah.
And in any event, its holding doesn't conflict with Olivares, which we believe is the case, the only case that this court needs to look at. Love holds, quote, in a contractual agency, vicarious liability is founded upon the status created by the agreement. And as you'll see when I get to the argument, the agreement is pretty straightforward when it says ACS is not an agent and they're not an employee. End of story. It says it a couple of different times. So Olivares, which is more recent and more relevant to the Tort Claims Act question, simply takes Love further and adds color and flesh to that holding. It doesn't conflict with it in any way. But because Olivares is newer and because it deals with the Tort Claims Act case specifically, we think that it controls. Merck is equally unhelpful to the specific question posed in this appeal, and we don't argue with Merck. It simply stands for the idea that a person, quote, who exercises independent judgment in treating patients can be an employee of a governmental unit within the Tort Claims Act. Well, that's fine, but we're not talking about somebody just putting together independent judgment being an employee. We think that the analysis stops at the contract. But if you're going to look past the plain language of the contract that says, under no circumstances is ACS an employee or an agent, then you really need to open it up. That's a real fact-intensive scenario, one that includes what does it say, what do those words mean, right? Because sometimes the plain language of a particularly this 100 or even 1,000-page contract with the RFP attached, it can look like there are several points that conflict with each other. And so why were they written that way, and what does that mean? Well, the testimony that we entered as part of our motion for summary judgment and also as part of the response to the state's plea to the jurisdiction was to show that there are fact issues at play here about what was and was not the reality regarding what the contract said, what it meant, and how it was executed. So to the fact that there are, to the extent that there are disputed fact questions, I think that would preclude this court from doing anything that would overturn essentially the summary judgment of the trial court. That's with regard to those three cases, Your Honor. The sentence that I, that I...
Is it, may I ask this question on the, on conduit? Is it possible that conduit, because you have to admit that in the contract, it does use words kind of using agency or fiscal agent, and it uses the word contractor. They're in the many hundreds of pages. And I know which paragraph you're relying on as it relates to, you know, no way, no how, are they anything other than a contractor. But is it your position that conduit can be, in some of its aspects of work for the state, both an employee, an agent in some functions, and a contractor in others?
I don't know, because all I really care about is their prior authorization matters, whether or not they actually are an employee for other pieces. Writ large, for administrative stuff like writing checks, if they are for that, doesn't really matter. All that matters to the Malones is whether or not they would fit under a tort claims exception for the purposes of whether or not they would be an employee or agent, right? For that particular purpose. Now, and that's something that the state, I'm sorry, that ACS has made a point of, and that is there's some sort of use of the term agent in the Malone's petition that is dispositive or an admission. But the truth is, the Malones use the term agent the same way the state used the term agent in the contract. And that is to say that they could be the person who was in charge of something. Whether or not they were in control of it or not might be a fact issue. And ultimately, whether the state could control that or should have controlled that might be a fact issue. But that's not an admission of any of in any way that would bind this court. The same way that, and here's the issue. This is what was expressly provided for in the contract. And whether the state exercised control over that are fact questions. But I would submit to you that the simple use of the term agent in the contract can't be enough to create an agency relationship. Even if the contract says, I think in one part it's the RFP that actually says that. The ACS will be considered the administrative agent or perhaps the fiscal agent for the state. Well, that can't be enough. What does that mean? And how deeply does that go? Those are all fact questions that I don't think, especially in a multi-hundred or even thousand-page contract, which actually is not one document, it's several documents. It's an RFP that's then superseded by an overriding contract where the contract says, oh, to the extent this contract conflicts with the RFP, the contract controls. So you've got all sorts of different issues related to and by the way, it's in the contract where the statement is conduit is not an agent or an employee, even though the RFP uses the term administrative agent. So if there's a conflict, it would be the later in time document and the master document that we would say would control.
How do you deal with the part of the agreement that says the state will review and approve all vendor proposed medical criteria as specified in the medical policy and or rule used to authorize services that require prior authorization, and that the state will review and approve the vendor recommended format of all PA request forms and related material? Does that not show that the buck stops at the state?
Well, as Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until they get punched. And what I would say is that might have been what they said at the beginning, but that's not the way it played out. And that's not what Vivian LaFuente and several other people that, I mean, we took 100 days of deposition so far in this case. I traveled all over the country for things related to what ACS knew and what the state knew and all of that. So, and how things were meant. But nowhere was the issue of agency ever brought up, because this wasn't even a matter that was pled until after all those depositions were either fully completed or largely completed, and certainly after Vivian LaFuente and a bunch of HHSC and ACS leadership had been deposed. So it's really unfair, we thought that the ACS would plow up something a Texas Tort Claims Act has never been mentioned by the state or by ACS in any of the different, in the 321 lawsuit or the 5380 lawsuit, has never been mentioned at all. And the idea that somehow we would have waived that because we didn't ask for more discovery, I'll tell you, is difficult to stomach when we didn't ask for more discovery because we asked the judge to just simply strike the new affirmative defenses that they pled, and the judge said no. At the same time, she struck, at the same hearing in which she struck their motion for summary judgment. So there hasn't been any time to ask for additional discovery. But certainly, should this case be remanded for that issue, that would come up.
What about the argument that the federal government required the state to maintain control over all this? I mean, what's your response to that?
Because the law says that you have to do something doesn't mean that it's done. And that's part of the underlying tension in this case, is that what did the state allow and what didn't they allow? And to what extent was ACS given free rein to do something that, at least according to the federal statute, wasn't allowed? And even though the state said, we're going to set the criteria, or we're going to oversee and review the criteria that you set out, to what extent did they ever actually do that? And how detailed were those criteria? Because at the end of the day, I'm not sure that there was anything beyond what the RFP issued at 8.9.1, where it says, you've just got to disposition these correctly, which is really literally effectively what one of the RFPs says. Whatever is brought in, you look at it, use medical judgment with experts, and decide whether it's medically necessary or not. So the federal government does say, Justice Smith, that's what was required to be done, but that's not dispositive in this case, just because if that was the case, then the state could never do wrong. It's just a matter of what the law says, that they have to, that they can't outsource the matter. So they couldn't have, but they did, at least in this case.
Did you say earlier, though, that we should just stop with the contract, and then now you're telling us that we can, the contract might say one thing, but what actually transpired is completely different, and that's what we should be looking at?
No, I think that you stop with the contract. But I think if you want to get beyond, and this gets to Justice Theofanis' issue, which is, then why all of this insurance and liability talk? If you're somebody that's covered by the Tort Claims Act or you have immunity, then why? What would be the need to have all of this stuff in the contract that holds you liable, even to third parties, for negligent and intentional acts? If we're going to go past the idea that the contract says that you are not an employee or agent, then it's a pretty deep factual dive, I believe, and one that either the record hasn't been developed enough for this court to reverse on, or one that needs to, should the court believe that the Texas Tort Claims Act might apply in this case, then the best remedy that I think ACS could get from this court would be to remand for a greater fact-finding on that issue. Because if you're going to get beyond the idea of the plain statement that says, under no circumstances is ACS an employer or an agent, and you're going to get into whether they actually were or weren't, then you really need to get into all the parts of that. What does the liability pieces mean? What is the consequence of the
authorization
statutes and the oversight.
And counsel, if you'll wrap up.
Yes, ma'am. Yes. We would ask that that on both of the points that you sustain the trial court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's hear from the appellants in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'll try to make it through all of my points quickly. I'll pick up where my colleague left off about greater fact development. He wants greater fact development on actual exercise of control, and every argument he made to this court was about actual exercise of control. He's asking this court to commit clear reversible error by relying on the actual exercise of control rather than the legal right to control. And he talks about the federal clawback. Well, why was the federal government going after the state instead of going after Conduent? Because the state was responsible for its agent. In his brief, he talks about, well, we don't know what agent means. We absolutely know what agent means. Agent is the ordinary meaning of agent is clear to everyone, and it's clear from their petition where they talk about alternatively they were acting outside the scope of their agency that they understand what agent means. And when my colleague says that the contract said in no way could they be an agent, he's simply misrepresenting the contract. Section 5.6 expressly contemplates that Conduent will be the agent because it says it starts with a proviso that subordinates the rest of that clause, and it says except as expressly provided in this agreement or as agreed to by HHSC. And he tries to separate the RFP. We can stick with the administrative services agreement. It itself says that Conduent will be the fiscal agent for operational phase services, which is basically the running of Medicaid, which includes prior authorization. And he says that at page 2 of his brief. He says the state fired Conduent as their fiscal agent for prior authorizations. It's always been clear to everyone that Conduent is the agent here. And again, when he talks about the state losing control, they had to have control to lose it, right? And so they had the legal right to control Conduent. There's no fact question of what's in the contract. And he cites to Olivieres about labels. But Olivieres itself says that that what's going on here, it says the label, and it says and the terms of the contract. And what Volkswagen says, he talks about the facts of Volkswagen, I'm talking about the legal rule. Well, Volkswagen said, it says you're trying to disclaim agency, but what do the substantive terms of the contract say? And the substantive terms of that contract said you're gonna do this, you need to, when we tell you how to do this and tell you to do something, you're going to do it. And that was enough under Volkswagen. So there can't be any fact issues here. The contract is clear, and the actual exercise of control simply does not matter. And if I could spend a little bit of time on sovereign immunity, there are two holdings in Nettles. And one is the one that matters here is about a theory that depends on fraudulent conduct by the state, in that you have to override the substance of what the state did. Now, the state's choice, so they say that this has nothing to do with the state. I would ask the court to look at paragraph 69 of their...
Something went wrong.
I do apologize for that. That's my fault for using using technology. I would ask the court to look to paragraph 69 of their complaint, in which their entire theory of damages is not from anything Conduent did. It's from the state's choice to bring enforcement actions against them. So their claims against Conduent are derivative of what the states did. And any trial in this case is necessarily going to turn on why the state did that, because if it was its independent judgment, then that's a superseding cause that will break the chain of causation, and they cannot succeed. They can only succeed by showing that the state's enforcement decision was of one event with Conduent's alleged misconduct. And the way they do that, the reason they haven't changed their complaint over a decade is because these are strategic allegations. They've kept these allegations in, and they are stuck with their pleaded theory, and their allegation is that this was all part of the state protecting Conduent. And they talk about how they've got claims that are separated. I'm talking about their general factual allegations that they incorporate into every single claim in their case, and that's why this case falls under Nettles as well. And if there are no further questions, we would ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you both for well-briefed and interesting argument on this important issue. The court will stand in recess and the case will be submitted. Thank you.